Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to The Hobcast Book Show, episode number 96. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Crime.
And suspense.
Well done.
Thank you. Welcome to the show. And our guest this week is Kat Yaff, who is both a novelist and an expert in digital marketing
she
as well.
She knows a lot, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She really does. And we've met Kat before at both Crimefest and at Harrogate. And she has some rather wonderful news to share with us, personal news, when we interviewed her a few days ago.
Yes, so lovely, lovely news.
Yeah. So Kat, crime author and marketer extraordinaire, and something else as well. So we'll tell you about that later when we speak to Kat. Let's get into the news let's crack on in the show this week. And lots to go. Let's have a look at the Twitter situation since we spoke about it last week. And you were in a situation where you were sort of saying, well, we have to stay on it and, you know, we have to disregard any issues about Elon Musk taking sole control and all that sort of thing. Well, has that view shifted?
Not entirely. So we still use Twitter. The majority of our social media engagement is on Twitter. So we haven't left Twitter or anything like that. But I noticed yesterday that quite a few of the people we follow were saying, ooh, I'm going to move over to Mastodon.
Yeah, which is another platform.
Well, I'd never heard of it. I thought, Mastodon, that sounds like something from Doctor Who. What's that? Yeah. And it was Angela Mahan, who was the first person I saw, who we interviewed here on the podcast, didn't we?
Angela McMahon.
Yes.
Yes, good try.
So she was the first person I found on Mastodon when I registered Hoback there. Now we have, I think we have about 25 followers and we're following about 30 people. So we're getting there. It looks the same as Twitter, but there are some differences. For example, you belong to a community and you can't automatically find people in different communities. So I don't know how you seek out other people who happen to be in a different community to you, unless you put in the full address of where they are. It's a little complicated.
Okay.
Everything else looks the same. You like things. You you re-toot. I don't know. Re-mastodon things.
Yeah. What do you do in Mastodon? I don't want to speculate. Anyway. So that's. I mean, you know, in the wider world, the significant changes at Twitter. So, just a few days ago, on Friday, in fact, Elon Musk sacked half the staff worldwide, and he did it in a really awful way. If you could log into your personal your work email, then you were all right. And if you couldn't, and you had presumably your laptop locked out of the system, then you pretty much knew you were going. But then you got an email in your personal inbox telling you you'd been fired. Now, his explanation for what's going on is partly to try and make it profitable. Twitter is losing money. He's bought a company that is losing money. He spent $44 billion buying it, and its market value is only $15 billion. And it's looking very hubristic at the moment. He is the sole director of Twitter now. He's basically got rid of everybody who ran Twitter. And the thing that he is championing, he says, is real free speech. And he has basically decided that what he's going to do away with, most of all, is the way that the old version of Twitter used to sit in judgment on certain accounts, particularly right-wing ones like Donald Trump's and other conspiracy theorists and various other people. Now, what has happened in the weeks you know, on the days since he took over as well, apart from the sackings, is in fact an awful lot of advertisers have pulled out of Twitter or frozen their interest, and indeed quite a number of very significant public figures, including Stephen King, has shut down his Twitter account.
No. Oh dear. Well, he's if his ambition is to make Twitter profitable, he's not going the right way.
No, so it's an interesting thing. But I mean, I think that my personal concern, and this is not really relevant to Hoback, is the fact that Twitter had become and is a playground for bots. In terms of about 30%, it's thought, of the accounts on Twitter are set up to propagate certain points of view, but done electronically. So they're not real people. They're fake, you know, effectively fake accounts. And that's a concern. And also, you know, if you take away the moderation, then an awful lot of things which are very unsavory will be back on Twitter that have been perhaps been restricted in, you know, after much campaigning to try and influence what's on there.
But most people we follow as Hoback are book bloggers, readers, reviewers. They're not automatic, are they?
No, I mean, but you know, sometimes you have to think to yourself, you know, is it a platform you want to be swimming in on, you know?
Only, do you know, from completely selfish reasons, it's taken us 2 years to build up.
I know. But this is the nature of the whole electronic world at the moment, is that, you know, people are starting to question what lies behind all of these things, including Facebook and Amazon and all that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a degree of scepticism is creeping into the world, whereas, you know, it was all exciting to join a few years ago. The fact is that it's not the same. These aren't the same platforms they were a few years ago. It's not just people putting up their puppy pictures and whatever on Facebook. There's a lot more under the hood and behind the scenes that's going on to influence what we think and what we see. So that's all I'm asking is, you know, at what stage, you know, do we do the Mastodon migration completely?
Well, I think...
Or do we?
Well, it's one of those things, you know, people are a bit like sheep, aren't they? Somebody goes, other people follow, and other people follow. You get to a tipping point, don't you, where there would be so few of the people who we relied on to keep our business sort of churning over have gone onto Mastodon. And of course, we will concentrate more on that. I mean, I am sort of looking at it and then trying to find new followers every now and then, but I'm not spending a massive amount of time on it because it is time consuming.
That is the nature of social media. And, you know, the fact is you're damned with and damned without. That's the truth of it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the debate that continues. And, you know, everyone is watching what Elon Musk is up to. And
I still think he sounds like aftershave.
Well, to some extent. And, you know, his hair transplant just does my head in when I look at his hair. Because that's not real. No.
Oh.
No, that luxurious quiff is not real.
Oh, I never knew that.
No, because if you look at pictures from him just a few years ago when he was launching Tesla and trying to get it going, he'd very, very thinning at the front there.
Oh, right.
Very much so.
Does he think it makes him more attractive?
Who knows? I mean, look, he's the richest man in the world that's ever lived. You know.
If he offered to buy me a gin and tonic, would I say yes?
I don't know. I think he'd probably freak you out, to be perfectly honest.
But, I don't know. I wouldn't recognise him.
Well, no, but I mean, apparently he looks at people in a very intense way. Apparently, it's one of the things he does if he pays you any attention whatsoever. So, interesting. Anyway, look, that's the Twitter situation. In the wider world, we've talked a lot about the cost of living crisis, and naturally that is going to impact on people's ability to buy books, but it's also going to impact on their ability to produce books. Two things happened this week that we ought to just touch on. First of all, I welcome this from Canongate, who are an independent Scottish publisher and recently published Ian Rankin's The Dark Remains, which was his extrapolation of the notes of William McIlvany. We met one of the guys from Canongate, the lovely people. Anyway, they're actually paying their staff an extra little bit of money to help them with the cost of living crisis every month, which I think is great.
It is great. Maybe we should do the same. I'll give you an extra 10 quid if you give me an extra 10 quid.
Maybe if we paid ourselves anything, it would be a miracle. But I think that's really welcome. And, you know, clearly some of the other big publishers might look at it that way. But publishing is notoriously badly paid anyway. So anything that helps. I mean, we're not talking about big sums of money, I don't think. I think for the sort of staff on the lower end of the salaries, they're getting £250 a month extra and £100 for the ones who are higher up the ladder. But that's still a significant, you know, increase. And it's a sort of temporary grant kind of thing.
Mm.
But, you know,
it's a nice gesture.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And The other sort of piece of news, which has sort of affected a lot of people that we know, is the issues for Dark Edge Press.
So it's a very sad news, really, that Dark Edge Press have come to the conclusion that they will have to cease trading a year from now, December 2023. We haven't really had much to do with Dark Edge Press.
We know a number of their authors.
Yeah, so we spoke to a couple at Harrogate, didn't we?
You know, we rubbed shoulders with people, and clearly distressing for those authors who aren't getting the remainder of their contracts. They won't get their books published by Dark Edge Press. But look, I want to say this because we did a podcast this week, which is going out in a couple of weeks' time, where we joined up with Karen Sullivan, who we mentioned a few weeks ago from Miranda Books, and talked about the issues that we're all finding as indie publishers. And Philippa kindly invited us on. And it really is pretty stark. Listening to what Karen was saying about the impact of so many factors at the moment on her business and its long-established, award-winning business with some fantastically well-known authors, and great penetration into the book market in the UK, and it's a real struggle. So I think that I have every sympathy with authors who aren't seeing their books published. But I want to say a word for Dark Edge Press, because it would be absolute torture to try, you know, having launched a business to be in a position where you know you've got to shut it down.
Mm.
And, you know, goodness knows, it's something that, you know, any business faces times of crisis, and it is the toughest trading position for publishing in years, frankly, at the moment.
Yeah, and I think once you get to that point, you've tried everything you can. You know, you do everything you can to prevent that eventuality happening. So, you know, it's very tough.
So tough on everybody involved. And, you know, I just wanted to sort of reach out and say, you know,
good luck to the authors in finding new homes.
Absolutely,
for their books.
Absolutely. And carry on the faith, you know, and keep writing. But it is tough. So let's not pretend. But, you know, that's sad news this week. Right. Well, on that basis, let's get to our interview with Kat Yaff. And we met Kat at Crimefest for the first time. We'd already been in touch quite a bit. We have a little sort of group on Discord of indie writers and publishers, and we've been chatting there. And it was really great to meet her. And she was emerging from chemo at that point. And when we spoke to her a week or so ago, you know, things were looking very optimistic in terms of, you know, her health. And what time we saw her at Harrogate, she was still suffering from the impact of chemo and radiotherapy for breast cancer, and you know, her hair was returning.
Yes,
and that, you know, and she, it was a really big thing for her to go to Harrogate, and it was great to see her. And as she'll tell us in this interview, she had some really good news on that front. But this interview is about her work in the creative arts as a marketer as well. She had her own marketing company, and now as a writer. And, you know, there's so much to take from this.
Yes, indeed.
She speaks a lot of sound sense. So let's speak to Kat Yaff. What a great pleasure it is to speak to Kat Yaff from your shed.
Hello.
Is it a writer's shed?
It's called the Shed of Words.
Ooh.
It has its own plaque and everything.
It's brilliant.
It has a plaque. That is quite cool.
I know you're not showing this on camera, but I'll show you to it. There you go.
It really does. It has a plaque and it says Shed of Words. That's really fancy. Brilliant. I love it.
Yeah. She's quite old.
We all need a Shed of Words. Unfortunately, we don't stretch that here, but I've now got a little space, which is next to my studio with a blank wall and a picture of Clive James propped against it. And you are in the kitchen still.
I've always been in the kitchen. I have to be in the middle of everything because people come in asking, can I have a cup of tea? Where's a, I don't know, cat? I can't find my rugby kit. So I've got to be available.
Yeah.
True enough. Well, thank you for joining us. And we're going to talk about a number of things.
Yes.
You've had a really interesting career as well, leading up to this point where you're now a fiction writer. But let's talk about your fiction. And we're all very excited because book three of the series is coming out soon. Tell us about your series.
It's not coming out right now, so you don't need to be scared.
Honestly, you've no idea how excited I am. I've affectionately referred to this book as the book that refused to write itself, and it has been written in hospital corridors. I literally had a nurse pumping chemotherapy into the back of my hand while she was asking when the next book was coming out. It's not out until March because I want to give a good shot at getting at that coveted number one spot. And I've forgotten your question, Adrian.
Well, how's it feel?
I think.
Yeah, and well, yeah, partly that, and how it sort of take us through your series in the sense of, with book three coming out, where things have developed.
Okay, so I never intended to write a series, and I never intended to write a police procedural. And in fact, when I first started with the first book, it was never even going to be a crime thriller. It was like a airy fairy romantic fluffy thing. But I'm a bit addicted to true crime podcasts. I watch true crime continuously, and as I was writing it, I bored myself. I was like, oh my god. And then she kisses it. Oh no, I'm having that. And it took a bit of a dark turn. So, and then of course the neurons are firing off left, right, and center. And oh, can you do this? And how does that happen? When can you do this? So it turned into a crime thriller. And as I was writing it, a character in that book, the DI, Ziggy Thorns, kind of just said, I've got more to tell. I've got more stories for you. So the second book came around and I wrote it in 6 weeks. Sent it to my amazing editor, who's Rebecca Miller. And when I got it back, I didn't like it, so I binned it. So I rewrote it, completely. It took a bit more time, took me 3 months, and it went a little bit darker as a serial killer involved. And then once I'd done that, I kind of thought, what is it you enjoy about writing crime thrillers? And it is the police side of it. It's the thinking how a criminal, a killer, a murderer works, and then how does that feed into like the police side of it as well. So I had some great conversations with Graham Bartlett, police advisor, I think everybody knows him.
Yes.
So it developed from there. So I've called the first three books a series, although Ziggy appears in all three. The first one is more Kate's story, and it's more of a, you can read that as a standalone, but the second and the third are meant to be read kind of together. Mm. But I'm going to put them out as a box set. They're called Tangled Web, and the overriding arc for those is how well do you know those around you? And can you truly ever trust anybody, even your closest friend or your partner? I feel that each book has explored that theme, and then I'm now moving on. Book four, which is coming out next year, will be part of a new series, but we'll have the same characters, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So a new arc. Thematically, it'll be different.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, that's an interesting prospect, isn't it? In the sense that you can look at your characters afresh. That new paradigm, really.
Yeah, that's it. And I think the more I feel that with each book I'm kind of perfecting my craft, and I'm feeling more confident with where I can take the characters and where I can push the storyline. I mean, in book three, When We Deceive, which is out in March, I really take Ziggy to the edge of what his character can and can't do and what he can get away with. And one of the when I sent it across to Rebecca, one of the things was, have I gone too far? Is there too much? Have I pushed him too far? Like, would a normal person just crack under this amount of pressure? So I'm waiting to see what her feedback on that. But I have to say, the husband has read it and he said it was good.
Oh, that's good. Does he read everything you write then?
He's the first one to read it as soon as I finished it, yeah.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned Rebecca, because Rebecca Miller we're talking about.
A great name.
Well, the Miller bit. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with it. Rebecca has worked with Simon McLeave as well
on the first year
of his Snowdonia series. And, you know, she has a fantastic reputation. So how is it? I mean, we always ask authors this. But how do you react when you get your notes back from your editor?
Well, many years ago, I did get a two-book publishing deal with the Big Five, and one of the Big Five, rather, and I sent it off to the editor when it came back. There was so much red pen. I threw it, put it in a drawer, and never saw it again. So I explained this to Rebecca, and I said, look, it turns out I'm a bit sensitive. And she... it was very gentle with me, and when it came back, when the second book came back, I took everything that she'd said on board and realised that actually I don't have to take every piece of advice that she gives me. But Rebecca is so clever and she's so good at what she does that it wasn't offensive. It was like, all right, okay, yeah, I see where that character can go. Yeah, absolutely. And even, so we're doing a developmental edit on this one, because it was written so disjointed, I just felt I needed that extra input. But even with a copy edit, she's still so detailed that it was a joy, actually. It was something that I was absolutely dreading, turned into be something really enjoyable. And that was like completely unexpected. I thought I would just crawl under a desk, drink gin, and never appear again.
But I think that's how it should be, shouldn't it? Because, I mean, one thing I was taught to be an editor is to just always be kind and remember that, you know, the authors are sensitive about their work because it's your baby. You've nurtured it. You've developed it. You've grown it. And then somebody comes in and says, you can't say that. Of course you're going to be upset.
Yeah, but there was nice little things in the margins as well that I love this bit. Yeah, this is brilliant, keep this up. And it was just like little motivational flags as I was going through the copy, which helped massively. I never knew I was sensitive. I thought it was quite a tough old Yorkshire bird with paraphrase.
Well, it is so close to you when you're writing something, and you know, we've been doing some editing this last week or two, and it is difficult to find the right balance of passing on what needs to be said in terms of improving storytelling or delivering the ambition of the book, which, you know, let's be honest, not every scene is going to work where it needs to be. Not every character is going to be consistent with how you've set them up. And, you know, there are going to be alarm bells ringing, and there'll be bits which perhaps take you out of the story because they're just not perhaps in the right place or expressed, you know, clearly enough, that kind of stuff. It is really, really difficult to find the balance.
But then even when he reads my blurbs and he changes things, I have to stop myself from thinking, huh?
That's true. Yeah.
I think as well, I took it as a huge learning point. So one of the things that was just up... that came up again was head hopping. And I had no idea that that was a thing or that I was so prolific at it. So it was, as I'm writing the third book, I'm actually thinking, oh, wait a second, you're head hopping, you know, and again, and the showing not telling, and the, you know, simple stuff that you probably learn in school, but at 51 I've completely forgotten. And that's what I mean by learning every time with every book that you write. So hopefully, I mean, Rebecca has got her work cut out for her with book three, but hopefully as time goes on, there'll be less of that.
I think it's an interesting thing you mentioned with head hopping, because it's a thing no one ever talks about.
No, you don't learn that at school at all. And it is a really common error.
I mean,
our writers have been.
And I must have, I have a, you know, a growing library, because I've added about three or four books to it this week, on the craft, whether it's crime writing. Bear with me. That's my son. Sorry, James. the fact is that I've got dozens of books on different aspects of the craft.
He does. I mean,
but none of them ever talk about the problem of head hopping.
No, then we need to write it.
Maybe we do.
We do need to write the head hopping.
I didn't know it was a thing. I didn't, and the thing, and then once I'd learned what it was, I saw it everywhere.
Yes, I do now. Yeah.
Books, but in every book I've read, every manuscript I've been sent to review, I'm like, oh, head hopping. And showing, not telling as well, but I think that's quite a common one. But yes.
I think that's a more delicate one, actually.
Yeah.
I think the head hopping thing, once you know there's an issue, you see it, as you say, everywhere. But with the showing, don't tell thing, I mean, that is.
That's a scale.
There's a whole load of nuance in there, you know, and one person's telling is another person's showing, and you know, so that's not so easy.
Do you know, I wonder about show and tell, right? Is it because we all look at our environment in a different way? Some people may tell it in their head in more detail than other people, so they think that that's how they should write it, because they notice so much about their environment that they think, as a writer, well, that's how everybody thinks, so that's what I'll put on the paper.
I think mine comes back to some training. I've worked as a freelance journalist for many years, and I think I was very economical with words, so it was just get to the point, no flower, no messing about, nobody's interested, just tell me the story, tell me what it is, I don't want the rest of it. And I think it's some of that training, really, that influenced how I write. I should probably show more.
Yeah, I think I share that with you. I mean, I'm a broadcast journalist, so it's slightly different, but nonetheless, when I started, it was all about the writing, and indeed in broadcast, actually, you know, you often have fewer words than you would in print to work with. And yeah, it is about stripping it back and to the barest essentials. And if you can put a little bit, when it was broadcasting, if you could write something that was good for the ear as well, that pricked your interest rather than just told you what's happening in front of you in terms of television or whatever. My hands are going all over the shop today.
Got my hands as well.
it has impacted my writing too. Yeah. Actually.
Well, I would say in terms of blurb writing, so. What we tend to take it in turns to write blurb, don't we? And then when I write it, you have a way of just saying the same thing in a sentence with half the number of words, and
with all the commas stripped out.
Yeah, and that's because of the way you've been taught to write.
Absolutely, it's copywriting. I mean, you know, and it's form, you know, and without, as you say, the adornment that you would probably put if you're writing an advertorial or something like that. But you've been working in marketing as well, so you know that.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
So you've had to adjust to what's needed there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, working in marketing, you're so aware of kind of SEO and keywords and all that stuff. It's a very different animal altogether, completely, from journalism, from fiction writing. It's a whole beast of its own.
It really is. I mean, I have your book here, Digital Marketing.
I had put it in the toilet to read, but
made easy. And then you put it, and then you hid it in one of the bookshelves.
No, I wanted to read it.
I know, but then it somehow managed to land on a bookshelf, and I went and had to find it this morning. Anyway,
you're one of the people that bought it.
Well, look, I really enjoyed it, but the thing was that the more I went into it, the difficulty with the marketing side of it is that, you know, it is its own language, and actually understanding what those terms mean in a practical sense is where sometimes personally I struggle. And I always used to struggle with the BBC, because the BBC, when I first joined, was purely a broadcasting company. Mm. My hand is going again. I'm trying to keep it off screen. But online came into our world about 5 years into my time there.
Mm.
And everything changed. All the emphasis on how we did our broadcasting had to be changed so that it appealed to SEO, search engine optimization, for those who don't know. And all of the metrics that
apply in online, never applied in broadcast.
Mm.
I mean, this is the thing that, you know, you can die in the detail and the data. There's so much of it.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, what your book helps to do is to figure out what's important.
Yeah.
What you should prioritize in amongst all that data.
Yeah. I think that when I wrote it as a free giveaway, really. It was a lead magnet to try. A lead magnet is something that you put on the website to get people's email addresses. And that's what I was trying to do. This is maybe 4 years ago, 5 years mm-hmm. ago, when I was still helping small businesses with the digital marketing, basically. And I did it as I launched it as a lead magnet. And I wanted it to be, I think I say it in the book, you know, there is so much wizardry around digital marketing, and you can spend thousands upon thousands upon thousands buying into programs and this, that, and other. And the actual reality of it is it's hard work, it's consistency, and it's knowing the sequence of events of how somebody buys something online.
Yes.
After those three, you've pretty much set it up. I mean, it's interesting because I've been doing for the last kind of 12 months, I've been pretty much out of writing as a business owner. But in the last 4 weeks, I've been able to kind of step back into that role. So I've been going back over my website. I've been building my email funnels and, you know, looking at what else is out there, what's changed. Is there anything that I'm not on top of that I need to be? And do you know what? Actually, the fundamentals are all still there. Good website, well-written copy, and a good automated system and running in the background, and that's all you need.
Yeah, and I think often people forget that third element. You can, I mean, the website, that's going to be a challenge for a lot of people. The copywriting, again, very difficult if you don't know how to do it, or you just, you know, putting those first words down, you challenge everything. But once you get the flow, it's fine.
Yeah.
But the third thing, getting the automations right, is something that I know we've struggled with, and we're still reviewing it and trying to get it sorted out, really. That feels quite daunting for a lot of people, I think.
It can do, but there are things out there to help you. I mean, my book, but something, right. So my goal this year has been to build my mailing list, because when I launched book two, my highest amount of sales came from my mailing list. So I know that I can tweet, I can Facebook, I can TikTok, all I want, but I know my sales are going to come from my email list. I think at the time I only had maybe 500 people on there, and I think it was over a 50% conversion rate. So 250 people, for example, bought that book.
Wow, that's very good.
So imagine if that list was 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. So that's my goal. I know that's where my sales are going to come from.
Yeah.
So this year, I've really, when I've had time, I've really focused, and like for the last end of this, until March when my book comes out, that's going to be my goal.
Mm.
I have time to sit and email everybody every day that signs up to my list. So I use MailerLite because it's cheap, but it's functional. I have a landing page, which is a single page website with one image, and it has one job: to get somebody's email address. That's it. There's no social links. There's no about us. There's no contact me, nothing. It's just a simple page with a book cover, some blurb, and at the bottom, give me your email address, get a free book. Once people sign up, they then get taken to Story Origin, which is where they can download the free ebook from.
Yeah.
2 days later, they get an automated email, which I've pre-written and set in the automated flow system within MailerLite. So it automatically triggers after 2 days to say, did you get your book? If you didn't, here's a reminder. By the way, this is who I am.
Yeah.
I think it's about a week.
You don't have any reminders about, by the way, this is who I am.
Extra guest on the podcast. Thank
you.
This week.
Thank you, Siri.
And it got switched on. So that's, and then I think it's about maybe a week, 10 days after that, there's a little bit more about me, how you can connect with me on social. I don't sell anything at this point. I give more stuff away, what I'm trying to do is tell people that they need me in their inbox, and I am super grateful that you are allowing me into your inbox every week, month, whatever it's going to be. And then once they've had time, or I consider they've had time to read the book, I'll ask if they've got time to leave me a review on Goodreads. And that's where the majority of my reviews come from as well.
Right.
Once they've gone through that welcome sequence of about four emails, they then drop into my main. So they, again, automated thing. They go from new sign-up group into Catherine Yaff author group, and they become part of my monthly newsletter. If they unsubscribe, fine, I don't want you. But if you're not interested in me, that's fine, because I only want people that are going to interact with me. And that's one of the big things in my emails as well, is that I'm here. You can email me. You're emailing me direct, you're not emailing a robot. I will answer you straight away if I can. And I get some lovely emails from people.
Yeah.
So for me, it's about building that relationship. And having the automated sequence working for me whilst I'm busy writing or promoting is the biggest conversion tool I have in my arsenal. Mm. And I know that, and I've just sent out for my review team, like way in advance, because I want to be a bit more organized this time. I've got so many people have signed up. I'm running a little promo on that as well. But all these people will then, although they're here for the review team, they'll then drop over into my main mailing list. So I've gone from maybe 500 at the start of this year to 5,000 by the end of it, simply by providing things for free and for having conversations. And it's all whilst I'm off writing or doing other things.
That's brilliant. And if you do get that 50% hit rate next book, then you you're heading towards number one, which is what your target is. So yeah, that does work. Yeah, I mean,
it go back to what I said, it's hard work, it's consistency, and it's using the automated system that's there. And it's so easy, so easy.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to nudge each other.
I was sitting here, I'm thinking we need to look at what we have in our automated system and just.
Yeah, there's a lot of detail,
you see.
I think
what you're saying is get rid of all that detail.
Well, I think it's an interesting stage we're at, which is, you know, you do your first, you know, the website, it got us our authors and all of that sort of thing. And that was what it was designed to do. But what it doesn't do now so much is really speak to our readers a bit more than it did, but it's still not angled for the readership as much as it was to put us out there to capture the wonderful authors that you know what I mean. I'm using SEO speak.
Chitty bang bang.
I'm the child catcher. Yeah, the author catcher. Lollipops. Yeah. Hobeck Badger. Now we've really gone down we've gone down the rabbit hole. But you know, it does remind us that, I mean, actually we are going through a sort of it seems to be a glacial process, because the fact is when you start, you can do this all afresh and then you hit the hit button when you're ready. But when you're already going and everything else is going on around, to actually make all those adjustments, like you're finding probably when you're refreshing your website at the moment, finding the time and the clarity to be able to do that is much, much harder. And that's certainly what we're finding, because we're doing the day-to-day as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm only able to do this now because I'm waiting for my edits back from Rebecca. I mean, when they come back, I'm hoping all of the background admin-y stuff will be done so that I can then get the edits done and move on and start writing book four. I do sometimes wonder how, I mean, I'm fortunate that I understand the digital marketing. I've been doing it for about 15 years. So we were very early adopters when we had our digital agency. But I do sometimes sit and wonder, if you haven't got that knowledge and you're an independent author, how in God's name you would start it? I don't know, which is why I said to you, Adrian, I'm thinking of rewriting that book geared towards authors, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a need for, I mean, there are lots of people out there purporting to give you the magic solution, the magic bullet. I mean, it's the same in everything. I mean, this morning I was looking from an audio point of view, and I'm thinking, I've got new software
which I need to master. And then there's somebody pops up on my, I don't know, Instagram saying, you know, sign up for this course, $300, and you'll be a master of Studio One editing software. No, not the master. But, you know, I'm the master.
You did sound like the master.
I should say master. I don't know. Anyway, the fact is there are plenty of people out there with the same thing, which is, you know, offering a course for every solution and making money from that. But, you know, trying to sort through which ones work or elements of which work and trying and finding your own path is really hard.
Yeah. It is. And I think with Digital Marketing Made Easy, the idea behind it was that it would help a small business, because it was geared to small business owners. It, you know, I knew a big conglomerate was never going to buy it. It was for small business owners, and it was a starting point. It was something that I hadn't been able to find for one of my clients, because they said, I just want something I could say that's on my desk that I can say, right, step one, this is an email provider. An email provider is somebody that where your emails are stored, and that can just take it through step by step. And I looked everywhere for it and I couldn't find it. So I thought, right, sod it, I'll write you then.
So, as you do.
But then that's how some of the best books have come about, though, isn't it? When the person thinks,
yeah,
the need, I need it, I'll write it then. So.
along with the book, I then on the back of that, there were, in fact, that's probably still are somewhere, I did a lot of courses and online training and things like that. So if you look on YouTube, I think I've got some YouTube videos up there that through the process as well. Have you seen them, Adrian?
Yes, I have, one or two.
God. I should probably take them down. There was like a whole business around it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Now, I mean, when we first met you at Bristol Crime Fest, that was just a few months ago. It was at the point where you were emerging from the other side of breast cancer, if that's the right way to describe it. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's fair. I was actually still having treatment.
Right.
Yeah, still having radiotherapy at that point.
Right. And clearly this is, I mean, stating the obvious, a major thing that you've overcome and a major turning point in your life. So how much has that changed your approach to what you do and how you do it?
Oh, massively. Absolutely massively. I mean, first of all, the amount of love and messages I've had from the writing community is unbelievable. When I saw you in Harrogate as well, it was just so emotional for me, because it was like me being brave enough to step out into the world. I didn't have very much hair. I was still bloated from all the steroids, particularly at Bristol. And it changes your perspective on things. I think I've always been quite a determined person anyway and a bit stubborn. This week I've been looking at, right, okay, so how can I improve my business, my author business? And I want to do more live events. I want to get out and meet people and meet readers and things like that. And I've thought, that means contacting shops and libraries and things like that. Woman, you've just beaten cancer. You can ring a bloody librarian, for God's sake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it's that, stop playing small. What is wrong with you? You've been given a lease of life that you didn't think you would have. Go for it. And it's all the fear has gone. There's still a bit of trepidation, but there's all the, wow, if I can do that, if I can survive this last 12 months, there is no stopping me now.
That's interesting, because, I mean, when we first met, certainly at Bristol, and I think that at Harrogate as well, I mean, that sense of you emerging back into the world was really significant for you. We felt that as we met you. And you talk about quite a few times, I mean, I've seen you talk about how, you know, going out in the world, you were rebuilding your confidence.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was, the you of prior to cancer would have not battered an eyelid probably in that environment, but just somehow the impact of the physical impact and the emotional impact that you've gone through and the hair, the whole thing, was really tough for you. And we felt that.
Yeah. I mean, during that, I mean, it was a really, really difficult time. In the space of 3 weeks, my dad had come home from hospital for end-of-life care for heart failure. The 2 days after he came home, my mum had a stroke and was diagnosed with dementia. And a week after that, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. So in the space of 3 weeks, the family was hit, bang, bang, bang. Well, I'd moved in with my mum and dad before my cancer diagnosis to care for my dad. Mm. My mum didn't really understand what was going on with her because of the dementia.
Yeah.
And my son was getting married at the end of that week. So I was trying to keep it all light and thing, and inside I'm absolutely dying. So over the space of 12 months, well, we lost dad in December, and mum moved into a care home in February. So it's been a really tough emotional time for me, and a lot of change. And I think when I finished the chemotherapy and I saw the tickets for Crime Fest in Bristol, I was like, I'm going. I do not care what stage of treatment I'm at. I am going. If I have to drag an IV, a drip with me, I don't care. I'm going. And the husband was like, we're okay. Knew better than to.
Sounds like you weren't going to be argued with anyway.
And he was like, is there any point in me telling you to take it easy? I was like, no, I'm going. And it wasn't until I'd actually checked into my hotel room and I sat there and I cried and I was like, I've got no hair, I'm bloated from the steroids, nothing fits me. I think at that point I could only get into leggings. I felt fat, horrible. And I was still very heavily bandaged and things. Mm-hmm. The courage it took for me to walk down those stairs. And it was actually Stephen Edgar, Steph, who was in the bar. Mm-hmm. Kind of walked in looking like this frightened mouse, and he was, you know, he just kind of said, are you here for Crime Fest? And I was like, yeah. And he went, come sit me then. Oh, it was just a massive sigh of relief because I was with my own people.
Yeah.
And then yeah. Weekend, just after that, it was that first thing, and then I kind of found my groove a little bit. And then the crown and glory was Harrogate, because again, it was just, I knew I'd be meeting with people that I'd met at Bristol, but I'd be meeting so many more people, and I'd been much more active on social media as well.
Mm-hmm.
That gave me just that little bit more confidence. And it was just like, big girl pants on, go out, smash it. You're going to meet people, you know, from Bristol, they're nice. And I was worried people would be standoffish, and it wasn't that at all. The love and the warmth. And the first person I saw was Donna Morfitt. Just threw her arms around me and went, oh, Kat. I was like, okay.
Lovely Donna.
Yeah, and everybody was just so welcoming, and it just reaffirmed to me that I'm absolutely in the right place at the right time, doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so important. I think, you know, we always approach these things, even though we're going as a double act, which makes it a lot easier.
Terrified.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely terrified. And it is always that very first person who sort of catches your eye and says, hi, who are you, or whatever, and makes you welcome, makes all the difference.
Well, a good example is the Shoreham, Fatal Shoreham, we went to recently.
Yeah.
In the morning, in the car, he said to me, oh, I don't want to do this. We're not going to do any podcasting. We just can't do this. We can't approach people.
I catastrophize every time. Every time we go to an event, I'm always like that.
And I'm used to it. So I just say to him, okay, if we don't do it, it's fine. We're just going along anyway. We're going to have a good day. It doesn't matter whether we do a podcast or not. We always do. We always do interview people. But you have to go through that sort of...
Sometimes you just have to take that pressure off yourself, I think.
Yeah.
Of yourself until you feel comfortable.
Yeah, it's permission to fail. We were very lucky because
we
arrived and pretty much almost immediately, you know, we were approached by Greg Moss,
Kate and Donna Moss, as well, actually,
and Donna. Donna was there, so that makes life, you know, and everyone, you know, it's amazing. And I will say this for Donna, and we're sorry for your loss this week, lost her,
her
grandfather, but you know, Donna is the heart and soul of the whole crime community, I think. And I think it's wonderful to see how many authors, these big names, recognise that and make a beeline
to
her.
Says to me, because she'll say to me, so-and-so came up to me and he said, you're Donna, aren't you? She can't understand that they know her. And I say, well, of course they know you, Donna. Everyone knows you because you are such a positive light in the, you know, the crime fiction.
Well, she gives to everybody. Everybody gets an opportunity to tell their story, regardless of whether they're the biggest names or new.
Yeah, she treats everybody the same.
Absolutely.
She, yeah.
And, you know, you can't fault that passion, can you?
No, not at all. And we were in, we went to bloody Scotland, and she was one of the first people I saw, and that smile, I mean, she just beams. And I was doing the talking bit. I got one of the spotlights and I was terrified. And she just made me feel so important, you know, and I just thought, I think I actually can do this.
Yeah.
And that's just how she makes you feel. I loved Donna.
Yeah. No, I think the community is full of people like that once you get to know them, but it's still intimidating going to these things. Yeah. But in terms of, you know, what you've gone through, which is absolutely hellish, as you've described, I mean, just unimaginable to many of us. How does that impact on your writing in terms of your insight for character? And, you know, when we're dealing with crime, we're dealing with human frailties, but also human, you know, avarice and all that stuff that goes in, mixed in, you know, greed, whatever it might be. What has it given to you? You know, your understanding of the human condition, if you like. It's a bit tossy, but you know what I mean. I'm trying to get, you know, not trying to turn into front row here on Radio 4, but what's it given to you as an author?
I think it's given me a depth that I probably didn't have before. And I think it's, so my dad and I were very close, and he is the one that got me into crime fiction way, way younger than I ever should have been introduced to it, really, with the Zodiac Killer. And we loved a good serial killer, me and my dad. when I was writing this book, part of the time, I would sit with my dad on a night, and he would say, don't write one of them books where it's really obvious what's going to happen, Catherine. It's only every person that calls me Catherine, everybody else calls me Kat. and I'd say to him, I gave him the brief outline, and he'd just go, no, this needs to happen, this needs to happen. So as I've been writing this one, I've felt my dad's voice in my head kind of going over, no, too obvious, no, cliched. But I think also a little bit of that the humbleness, I would say, of my dad has bled into the story through Ziggy's character in some ways. And I've tried to, I think maybe unknowingly, not consciously, there's more elements of my dad in Ziggy than I originally intended, in that I pushed him to his extremes, but he is a good dad.
Mm.
And he looks after his son, and his son comes first. And I think possibly I've mimicked my relationship with my dad in that.
I love that.
I love that too.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking,
make me feel all emotional.
I'm just transporting myself into your world, if you like, when you're writing. How does that feel when your dad's voice is,
I love it. So comforting. I love it. Mm. I'm very blessed to have the best dad. Don't care what anybody says, my dad were always best. And I can feel his arms around me when I'm writing. And it's because of him I've got the shed, because there was a garage here originally. It was full of asbestos, so it needed to come down. Yeah. And I was self-employed, and I said to my dad, I'd really like a shed instead of a garage. And he was like, what do you mean? So I took him out to this place, and he was looking, and he was like, man of few words, but he was, we'll see. Anyway, 2 days later, I got a phone call, we're having a shed delivered. So I can feel him in every eave, in every piece of wood that's in this place. It's very comforting.
Mm.
Very comforting, and also very challenging, because, you know, I want a character to do something, and I can hear this little voice going, nope.
He's still advising you, saying, no, wouldn't do that.
They should.
It's not Graham Bartlett's voice or something going in there.
Yeah, yeah, it as well.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I'm in the crime sphere, and I've been thinking a lot about this in the last fortnight about what makes a great crime book. And of course, all these elements of, you know, surprise and twists and all that stuff is important, of course, and avoiding cliche and, you know, and keeping it, you know, it doesn't have to be real. I mean, it can be complete fantasy in terms of the escapades that people get involved in, particularly if it's a thriller. But what I think now, which I probably didn't really understand a couple of years ago when we set up the company, is just how important it is to get those characters to be human.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I mean, really human. Yeah. I mean, not just, yeah, oh, let's give them a drink problem and a broken marriage.
Yeah.
And that'll do for the backstory. Yeah. But really, you know, in everything they do, they've got to be relatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things with Ziggy is, because I didn't set out to write a series, he's kind of developed as my writing has developed. And as I go into, as I finish book three now, but as I go into book four, five and six, I've got more of an idea of where I want him to go. But one of the things that really helped is I wrote his backstory in full. So rather than just give it like elements, I wrote it from birth until he joined the police. And it's actually a free short story on my website now. It was never meant to be. But so I've got about his relationship with his parents, with his siblings, his love. So he's from Liverpool originally. So it's his love of Liverpool Football Club, who his favourite players were when he was little, what position he played in the football team. And everything from how he became an orphan to moving into a foster home to, you know, to meeting his first wife. And I kind of had to do that. I think it was Stephen King that says, you need to put some meat on the bones. So I had the bones of Ziggy, and by writing that backstory in full, it gave me the meat. And he, you know, in my head now, I can see him as a full-fledged person. And about a relationship with his son, but also with his ex-wife. And I think there's this miss. I don't know how this is going to come out, but I think there's this misapprehension that men, maybe when they split up, don't give their kids as much time as they should do, or they're arguing with their, you know, they're bitter with their ex-wife. And I don't want that. That's not who Ziggy is. Ziggy remains, you know, he's a friendly guy. He's a nice guy. You'd want him around your dinner table. So I made sure he's got a good relationship with his wife, Rachel. His son, Ben, comes up, you know, first and foremost in everything that he does. And I think just by bringing that human element into it, well, I know some of the reviews had said, you know, it was refreshing to see a male lead who actually had that human touch to him, that showed not embarrassed or ashamed, to show his emotion, you know, and to say to his team, I'm having a bad day, you know, I just not with it today, guys. I need you to be firing on all cylinders because I'm not, you know, and it'd be okay to do that.
Yeah. So that's a really good point you raised, because I mean, you know, now I'm sort of feeling the echoes of my own story, in the sense that, you know, Rebecca and I got together from our two marriages and five kids between us. And I'm thinking, you know, probably not a good example of me putting my son first when he phoned and I killed the call. But it's true. My relationship is so much stronger, I think, bizarrely, through the, you know, not being in each other's pockets every day, because he doesn't see the moody me.
Well, both of them, your relationship's really strong, I think.
It's improved because I think distance has made us both reflect on the value that we bring to each other. And, you know, admittedly, most of the time I see my son James, it will be to do something fun.
Talk about wrestling
for hours, yes.
But, you know, my husband Mark has got two girls, Amelia and Jemima. Jemima's 13 today, Amelia's 16. Mark and I have been together for 12 years, and we have a great relationship. But Mark has the most enviable relationship with his daughters. they are so close, and they will talk to him about anything. And I've got a similar relationship with my son, and I just think we don't hear about that often enough.
No, we don't.
No, we always hear the bitter side. We never hear the positive side.
Yeah, and I just, for me, that was, I wanted my books to reflect that. I mean, in the first one, in The Lie She Told, Kate's relationship with her son Joe is very much my relationship with my son Daniel. Again, didn't realise it until, I think it was my cousin in Scotland read it and went, "That's you and Daniel." And I was like, "No, it isn't." And I went back and I was like, "Oh," into the point where she calls him Sunshine, which is what I call Daniel. It's like, "Oh, yeah, damn it is." it's that human element that you were talking about.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Listen, we ought to get to Rebecca's random question shortly, but
oh, yes.
I want to ask you a question about the year to come. So 2023.
Yes.
Given that, you know, in a sense, you can look forward to it now.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
The worst is behind you, we hope. Obviously,
no, I got the all clear last Friday. The first post-treatment mammogram, there was a few dodgy weeks where there was something, but it turns out that it's nothing. And last Friday, I got told that I'm all clear.
Oh, well, that's fantastic. Congratulations.
Yay.
That's brilliant. Yeah. That's absolutely brilliant. So now you can look at 2023, wow. Apart from the recession, the COVID, the Ukraine war, the government in tatters, the whole
that's
lot.
All macro stuff though,
but all the macro stuff, but in terms of you now looking forward to, obviously you've mentioned one book coming out in March,
yeah.
Another one, book four you're writing at the moment, which potentially yeah. comes out next year too,
yeah.
What do you want to achieve, I mean, in terms of things you want to do next year apart from those two things?
I want to have fun. The overriding, I want to have fun in everything that I do. I've a book coming out in March. I've got a little, I'll keep looking over there because I've got so many events written down. So I've got Bales in March, Crime Fest in May, UK Crime Book Club in June. We've got Harrogate again in July.
Yeah.
I am doing absolutely everything, everything. So we've got a book coming out at the end of March, hopefully book four by the end of May, and book five the beginning of October. So I want three books to come out next year.
Amazing.
And I want that number one spot.
Well, let's hope that the Hobcast book show is one of the ways you got there. Right, darling. It is time for your magic moment. And I'm going to give it the big build up as usual.
Rebecca's random question.
After this podcast, a bunch of aliens.
Great start.
Bomb your house and they say to you, you can only eat one meal every night for the rest of your life. What would you eat and why?
This is going to be really poncy. Should I go for that? Well, I'll go for my first choice, will be bouillabaisse. Yeah. Oh, so it's like a fish soup. Mm-hmm. Is the way to describe it. And you get little croutons that you float in it, and then you sprinkle cheese on top, and you yeah. let them get all soggy, and then you get a spoon, all your fingers, and just eat it like an absolute animal. And it's my favourite dish. And we were in France in the summer, and it's the first time I've had it in years. Oh, my mouth's watering now. The first time I've had it in years, I would have bouillabaisse.
Yeah,
aliens would let you do that.
In terms of your bouillabaisse, right now, I've had it where I've had the chunks of fish in it, and you know, it's almost been a fish pie, almost, when you put all the stuff on top. Or do you have it, you know, filtered and nice and smooth? I mean, how do you prefer it?
No. Give me those chunks.
Yeah.
Also, we used to go to the south of France quite a lot when I was a kid, and it was again my dad that introduced me to it. And there's a picture of me somewhere sat in this restaurant. And my mum had dressed me up in all these lovely little girly things. I really wasn't very girly. And I've got my sleeves pushed right up past my elbow. I've got my hands in the soup, and I've got juice running down my chin. And there's this big, like, because it gets served in like a china boat. Not a china boat, but you know what I mean? Like a pottery.
Yeah.
Almost a cauldron,
like
isn't
cauldron,
it?
Cauldron, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the one. And this cauldron's bigger than my head. And you can just see me on the other side of it. Yeah. Oh. Mm. Yeah.
Awesome.
would yours be?
God, like, you know, you asked me there. Well, I mean, I suppose if I had a really perfect bacon sarnie every night for tea, I'd be fine with that, with a bit of avocado in it. I'll tell you what, there's a sandwich that I used to get in Chichester. And you know, when I worked in Chichester, I had my little office, and it was in a tiny sort of like arcade, modern arcade. And one end of it was a deli, and they used to serve this thing called the chicken licking, with perfect bread, perfect avocado, crispy bacon, and chicken. And it was amazing. And it had lemon mayonnaise, and it didn't always, as you're probably thinking, oh God, horrible. But I would eat one of those every day with just the same gusto and passion every time, I'm sure. So
if the aliens storm our house, that's your choice.
Yes.
Mine is pickled cabbage with chunks of cheese on top.
Okay. Why?
Yeah, why?
I love pickled cabbage. I would eat pickled cabbage every day, and I love cheese.
Okay. Each to their own.
Yeah. You must come for dinner.
Yeah.
No,
I remember that.
I've been cooking proper meals. Tom Kerridge recipes. I've been liking them.
So no, they've been amazing. Fun. It's been an amazing week of an uptick in our nightly meals. But
this went on record yesterday. I heard the husband sometimes works in the shed with me, and yesterday I heard him say to one of his colleagues, I am sick to death of takeaways, because that's all we've had for last week. Oh, we'll go to people's houses, or we'll just, you know, we've left the microwave set up. We can microwave, think, oh no, we got Chinese, Indian. Line at McDonald's, but yeah, we've had takeaways.
Well, we do that once a week or so. We go to, you know, we have done in the past, McDonald's Monday.
Monday, yeah. Followed by University Challenge.
And it's not because of the food. It's because we'll get the kids together after their first day at school. We'll all be sat in the car eating.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant for having a proper, relaxed conversation, which you even can't achieve around the dinner table for some reason.
But, oh, I don't know. We talk about all sorts of weird stuff.
Well, it depends. Some days they're very quiet, but when we're doing McDonald's Monday, it all comes out, and it's just, that's brilliant. And you're watching the window steam up as your chips on the dashboard. Anyway, that's a little bit too much of us. Kat, where can people find you online?
So yeah, website katherineyaff.co.uk. Yaff's with a silent E. And yeah, pretty much everywhere, social media, Facebook, Katherine Yaff author, TikTok. I think I'm crime writer Katherine Yaff on there. But everything's on my website. And I've just launched a new feature on there as well, if I could just give that a little plug.
Of course.
So it's Feet Up Friday. I interview a different author every Friday. I used to have a podcast myself, but I just don't have time to do it now. So it's just a little blog post, 5 minutes, put your feet up, grab a biscuit, grab a brew. We've got AJ Amanda Campbell on there. We've got Tony Millington, Neil Bromage is coming up, and a whole load of others. So yeah, if you check out katherineyaff.co.uk and the blog, it's Feet Up Friday.
Fantastic. Well, like we'll check it out on Friday. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. And thank you for putting up with all my very, very intrusive questions.
No, they were very good.
And my weird pickled cabbage.
Yeah, we can't forgive them.
That was weird.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, what can you say? What a great way to finish an interview with that revelation that she's had the all clear.
I know. So we've gone from quite sad news earlier on, and now much good news for somebody. So it's not all bad.
No, it isn't. It isn't. Honestly, you know, we try not to be too maudlin and downbeat on this show. But we have always promised that it would be warts and all, and that's what it is. And let's talk about something a little lighter.
Yes. Yeah, so the sort of news I like to talk about.
Absolutely.
It's still publishing news.
Well, I'm just trying to find it now. So what we might just talk about is what we're going to be doing this week. And of course, we are launching a book. So let's talk about that first, and I'll get the right story up.
Yeah, so we're very excited to be publishing Maureen Myant's debut crime novel, which is The Confession, publishing tomorrow after this podcast goes out. And there is also a launch in Glasgow on Friday, which we weren't sure whether we'd be able to go to, but we have worked out a way to go. So we're going to be there in Glasgow at the Gallery Bookshop.
Yeah, fantastic. So that's 7 o'clock,
Friday.
Yeah, so if you're in Glasgow and you like books and you like wine, come along and say hi.
And so next week, we did promise you Maureen this week, but actually we're going to do an on location Hobcast next week.
Yeah, so we sort of
yomping around Glasgow locations.
And so a little bit from the book launch as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll bring you all of the spirit of that, and we'll bring the program from Scotland next week, which we're really excited about. So the little news story is always amusing. We did this last year, and there is an award for the oddest book titles. And that award, actually, they don't get any sort of prize.
No, it's just for fun, really, isn't it? They don't get a prize, but I'm sure it does help sales, you know.
I dare say it does. It's called the Diagram Prize, and this year's nominees, last year's winner, just to give you a sort of feel for...
Do you know, I nearly bought it.
It's Superman Circumcised.
Yes.
Which was a look at the Jewish origins of the Mensch of Steel, which was got 51% of the vote last year. This year's list for the Diagram Award for the weirdest book titles are as follows. Frankenstein Was a Vegetarian, Essays on Food Choice, Identity and Symbolism by Michael Owen Jones, published by the University Press of Mississippi. The Many Lives of Scary Clowns, Essays on Pennywise, Twisty, The Joker, Krusty and More by Ron Riecki, and that's published by McFarland and Co. Jane Austen and the Buddha, Teachers of Enlightenment by Catherine Duncan, also McFarland and Co.
They're good at their weird books.
And they've got another one. They've got another nominee. Rue Pedagogies of Realness, Essays on Teaching and Learning with RuPaul's Drag Race by Lindsay Bride and Tommy Mabry by McFarland and Co. again. And Smuggling Jesus Back into the Church by Andrew Fellows. And finally, What Nudism Exposes, An Unconventional History of Postwar Canada by Mary Ann Shantz.
Now that's the one I'm most intrigued by.
Yeah. And they're all, I mean, you know.
So you're telling me then that The Attack of the Purring Zombies is not in the list?
Yeah, the Geiger Cat Adventure.
The first saga of the Geiger Cat Adventures.
Some of you who followed the podcast closely will know that that's what we put out there on April the 1st this year as a potential Hoback title. But having reread the blurb that you wrote.
I wrote a brilliant blurb for that book.
Yeah, you did. I have to say, I want to read that book
well,
now.
So we've been talking about Kindle Vella quite a lot, and Kindle Vella is a platform that's available in the US, isn't it?
Yes.
Where you can publish episodic
fiction,
non-fiction and fiction, anything, and you can earn money through people reading your episodic fiction as it goes up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of doing The Attack of the Purring Zombies on Kindle Vella when we can.
Absolutely. Well, horror is very, very important on that. Apparently the most popular genres are romance, erotica, fantasy, and horror.
Okay, so maybe I will then.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Kindle Vella is not in the UK yet, and which is a real shame because they keep saying that it's going to be there, and some of the functionality has appeared on the dashboard for KDP.
Yeah, so I got quite excited, didn't I?
Yeah, you did. But you have to be in the United States to either consume it or write for it. Some people are making good money out of it, and it takes a different approach to the way you think about your marketing and obviously your way you produce your work, and you have to get people hooked in very quickly in essentially 3,000 words or so, and keep them reading. So pull a cliffhanger at the end of each one.
Oh, there will be cliffhangers in The Attack of the Purring Zombies.
Oh, I dare say. Well, that'll be
throw
exciting.
The cats off the cliff, that's what I say.
Well, look, it's been really busy. You've been working on Cooking the Books, which is our Christmas book, which you
makes it sound like I'm doing dodgy accounts.
You've put it on pre-sale on our website.
Yes, so Cooking the Books, you can buy, you can pre-order the cloth hardback from our website. You can order the ebook from Amazon. Pre-order the ebook from Amazon if you wish. But it's publishing on the 29th of November, so it's only 3 weeks from now, isn't it?
Yep.
So we're very excited about that.
Yep. You finished the cover. You've done the proofing, the prepping, and all that malarkey, the typesetting,
and all the the official legal stuff with the authors as well. That was actually quite time consuming.
It was time consuming. You're absolutely right. No, you're absolutely right.
And we've got a forward by R.C. Brigstock, which is
Brigstock.
Oh, it's every week.
Every week, dear. Get it wrong.
Yes.
Bob and Carol.
The lovely Bob and Carol, who've written a very entertaining and enlightening
Actually, it's a really good foreword. Yeah. I have to say, I buy it for that alone. It's
great. Because it's not just, you know, oh, it's an honour to be forwarding this book.
No.
Enjoy.
No. Well, to be fair, our previous forwarders haven't done that either.
But But
this one has, real insight into the power of food and the police. So that's terrific. As I say, we're sort of at the end of the week, we're up in Glasgow. In between times, mega, mega busy. You've just had an enormous car bill.
Yeah, so my car is not actually with us right now. I drove it to Stafford, which is about
10 miles away.
And as soon as I left the supermarket, it went da-dumpf, da-dumpf, da-dumpf. The front tyre was flat.
Yeah.
So we took it to Quick Fit this morning, and not just one tyre.
All four needed changing, and your front pads and discs because they were bare.
Yeah, so apparently I should have noticed.
Yeah, you should.
But I was listening to the Archers. I'm listening to, you know, Clary prattling away, and I can't hear what the brake pads are doing.
No, of course you can't. No one could hear that. Oh, dear, dear. Anyway, look, it's going to be another busy week as we build up to Glasgow. But thank you so much for joining us here on the Hopcast Book Show. Don't forget to go to our website, www.hobeck.net. Order the Cooking the Books, our Christmas book.
Yes, please.
Which is a charity book, and it supports the Trussell Trust and their work with food banks across the UK, which we're delighted to support. So all profits go there, basically.
And I should say, we've had some heart team feedback already on the Cooking the Books. Good.
So thank you for joining us. My name's been Adrian Hobart, and it still is.
It still is.
Hers is.
And mine in future will be Rebecca Collins.
Possibly Rebecca Hobart.
Oh, yeah.
If you keep playing your cards right. More on that next year. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. As I say, check out our website. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. It makes a huge difference to the impact that we make. We are grateful for every subscriber and every listener. So thank you for joining us. And all it remains for me to say, and indeed Rebecca, is have a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.